I'm Eddie Merckx. You listen to the Bicycle Show on Resonance 104.4 FM.
Il endosse tous les maillots.
Eddie Merckx.
Il est le roi du vélo.
Eddie Merckx.
Le monde entier applaudit.
Eddie Merckx.
L'enfant du pays. Il est le plus beau champion.
Eddie Merckx.
Et chacun crie son nom.
Eddie Merckx.
Il est notre favori.
Eddie Merckx.
Encore bravo pour Eddie. Un petit belge pour la petite reine, c'est sans problème, car c'est un super champion. Il sait mordre le guidon.
Eddie Merckx.
Il se bat comme un lion.
Eddie Merckx.
C'est le vrai Merckxissimo.
Eddie Merckx.
Et le plus costaud du monde, il est le champion.
Eddie Merckx.
Et ce n'est pas du bidon.
Eddie Merckx.
Pour décrocher le bouquet.
Eddie
met le grand braquet. Le Tour de France.
Welcome to the Bike Show here on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Jack Thurston, and for the next half hour, we're going to be talking about a man who is the undisputed greatest ever professional racing cyclist, Eddie Merckx.
Eddie Merckx.
Rien ne peut plus l'arrêter.
Eddie Merckx.
Il remporte tous les prix.
Eddie Merckx.
Pour faire plaisir aux amis.
Somewhat surprisingly, given the stature of Eddie Merckx's achievements in cycle sport, there's something of a dearth of books in the English language about him. But just like London buses, you wait forever, then two come along at once. And we're going to be hearing from both of the authors of these two new books about the cannibal Eddie Merckx. Here in the studio is Daniel Frieber, and on a telephone line from deep in the Welsh marches is William Fotheringham, cycling journalist for The Guardian newspaper. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Morning.
Hi.
I want to get into the Eddie Merckx story, but we need to talk about where he came from, where he was born. He's obviously a Belgian cyclist. Cycling is very important to Belgium, but let's flesh out that story. William.
Eddie's background's intriguing because he's not really one kind of Belgian or another. He's a Bruxellois. If you like, there are three kinds of Belgians. There are Walloons, Flemings and Bruxellois who live in the region around the capital. And Eddie was born in Flanders, but in terms of cycling Flanders, he's actually born slightly outside the mainstream, not in East or West Flanders, which is where most of the great cyclists come from, but in Brabant, sort of southeast of Brussels, into a Flemish-speaking village. And when he was very young, his parents moved to the suburbs of Brussels. So he grew up as a Bruxellois, but his first language was actually Flemish, but he perfected himself in French. He's also very good at talking the dialect that's around Brussels as well. So the interesting thing about his identity was that he was never really accepted by the Flamands, and he was never really a Walloon. He united Belgium because he came from the capital, but at the same time, he was never really totally rooted in the deepest heart of Belgian cycling culture, which is Flanders.
Was that an asset to him or a disadvantage, Daniel?
I think a lot of the time it was actually a disadvantage. As William said, he kind of divided Belgium. Everyone laid claim to him when things were going well, but then they could also equally quickly turn on him. Another aspect of this kind of dual sort of identity that he had was that he wasn't a typical Flandrian on the bike either, in the sense that Roger de Vlaeminck was one of Merckx's great rivals in the Belgian classics, and he really specialised in those races and only really had eyes for those races, although he won elsewhere as well. Whereas Merckx was so versatile that he couldn't be categorised as a Flandrian, which is another sort of nebulous concept that I think you're going to go into
later. Let's ask. I think we'd accept that Johan Rousseau was a Flandrian or is a Flandrian, and let's ask him to define what he understands by the term.
We have a special hat. So if you see the pictures here, Brickschot Eddy Merckx, Roger de Vlaeminck, you can see something specifically in the hat. Strange character, somebody who's won it. He's won to win. He wants to be the champion.
So that was Johan Rousseau at the exhibition of photographs of Flandrian bicycle races by Stephen van Vlaeteren a few years ago. I don't know whether he was having a joke with me about saying that it's something to do with the shape of the head. What do you reckon, William?
No, I don't think it's to do with the shape of the head. It's very much rooted with where they come from. It is to, you know, basically there's a summary. I think it's in the Tour of Flanders Museum at Oudenaarde, which says they have to be born in East or West Flanders. And the line I liked went something like this: they have to be able to ride until they don't know where they live anymore, until they don't know the name of their own village. Basically,
there is a kind of legend of the poor agricultural worker who uses his power on the bicycle to better himself. And that's not something that applies to Eddy Merckx, is it, really? We just had a crashing in the studio here. But, William, that's not where he came from, is it?
Daniel says that it was a disadvantage for Merckx not being a Flandrian, whereas actually I think it was an advantage because, to start with, he came from a slightly better-off background, which meant that he wasn't solely concerned with making a living on the bike. He had this almost amateurish attitude to racing. But I think also because he didn't come from Flanders, he avoided Flandrian culture, and he wasn't sort of cosseted and nurtured by a fan club. There weren't people around him saying, you know, you're fantastic, you know, when he was 19 and winning the local bike race. He was he didn't have it tougher, but he had to work harder at it in a different sort of way. The pressure was actually to go off and earn a good living doing something easy, and because he turned his back on that, I think he felt he actually had to give more on the bike. And also the fact that a lot of Flandrians get channeled into the classics because that's what they do. I mean, Johan Rousseau famously said that he would rather win the Tour of Flanders than the World Championship, and that applies to most of the Flandrians. By and large, they end up winning the Flandrian classics, and that's what they end up wanting to do. Whereas Merckx was never bound by that, and I think that's very important.
So let's talk about when he burst onto the scene. What was his breakthrough year? Where did he come from, and what was his breakthrough event? When did people suddenly start going, hang on, there's a new guy here?
The first two chapters of my book talk a lot about this, and, you know, when was the moment? Merckx himself thinks maybe it was the 68 Giro, which was the first one he won. I actually talk a lot about 67, which was it was the first Grand Tour he did, the 67 Giro. But that was really the season when, depending on who you were and how sort of alive to the danger you were, that was where either the wool was taken from your eyes, And you realise what was, you know, this kind of menace that was about to arrive on the scene and dominate. Or, you know, you sort of remained in denial. Someone like Rick Van Looy, for instance, who was coming to the end of his career, and a few others, they really were kind of blinkered to what was... Or perhaps Van Looy wasn't blinkered. He perhaps pretended to be blinkered, but perhaps he knew deep down also what was coming.
And so was it a particular style of riding, or was it just the results that he was getting that would make people notice?
One of the things that a few interviews said to me, that it was the style more than just the results. I mean, people talked about being terrorised, and this went on for years, particularly after 1969, which was the Tour de France, his first Tour de France that he won by 17 minutes. A few people said to me that, you know, that had an effect on people for years afterwards because they were terrified of attacking, because when you attacked Eddy Merckx, it was like dangling bait in front of his eyes, and he could just unleash fury and hell upon the race. So what they would do then, a lot of them became pragmatic, his big rivals, people like Felice Gimondi, the smart ones, started to ride a lot more conservatively and really to feed off the scraps.
So you're going to read a passage from the book that describes his style of riding.
This passage is the first passage in the book. It was actually inspired by a scene described to me by Barry Hoban, the British rider in the 1967 Tour of Flanders, and it describes the feeling of Merckx arriving at your back. Through the gloom, a blink of white, suspended between the twin strobes of a car's headlights. Seconds pass, the Merckx recedes. The scene sharpens. The picture acquires light, but also urgency, movement, violence. Two eyes blaze, two shoulders sway, two lips purse. Two thighs thump, pound and pummel. 100 metres closer to us, no 90, no 80, no 70, another figure advances on his bicycle. Here, somewhere in the dwindling airspace between them, 50 metres, now 40, the similarities end. They are as different as a tiger and a tabby cat, a flail and a combine harvester. Not in stature, but menace. Both gazes are fixed on the road, but the quarry's legs and heart now beat as though to the rhythm of death's chime. 20, 15, 10 metres. A raindrop topples off the hunter's nose. He doesn't twitch. He kicks and breathes harder. The prey wipes sweat from his forehead, then lowers and tilts his head to face the triangle of daylight between bicep and rib cage. He watches, waits, and listens. 1 second, two metres, one. Eddie Merckx's old teammate, Vittorio Adorni, used to say there was a key difference between Merckx and Jacques Anquetil, the cyclist he usurped as the world's greatest. Anquetil appeared without warning, as silent as deadly as a dagger in the back. His pedal stroke was soft, velvety. He arrived with a murmur. He was gone with a whoosh. Here was the difference between Master Jacques and Merckx, said Adorni. You heard Merckx, felt him. Not necessarily sounds, but signs, a sense. The feeling of something brewing, stirring at your back. A creepy intuition. Not the normal whirring of pedals and wheels, but a thudding through the atmosphere. A different way of pedalling from the rest of us, as Dino Zandigu, the 1967 Tour of Flanders, put it. A trouble. The rustling wrath of the one-man forest fire that Italian rider Giancarlo Ferretti said came upon professional cycling in the late 1960s and destroyed everything in its wake for nearly a decade.
Wow. Well, sounds like quite a sight. He was all over the bike, wasn't he? He wasn't a beautiful rider like Jacques Anquetil, who was very supple and flowing. He was sort of, you know, grappling with the bike.
He absolutely fought it. It's something that it's something that Daniel picks up on very well there, is the fact that, you know, he is all over the bike. He's such a physical presence. When you see him, you see old videos of him attacking the Tour, and he's almost like he's going to fall off his bike. He's fighting it so hard. He's pulling. He's using his shoulders and arms a lot more than most bike riders do.
And so it's not what you would consider to be good technique, and not what is taught at the modern bicycle academies.
No, it's the style of a rider who's very, very aggressive. It's not your classic style. It's like faster copy Jacques Anquetil, later maybe Stephen Roche, David Miller. You know, those guys who look absolutely, Bradley Wiggins even now, guys who look absolutely at one with their bikes, who don't seem to be using their upper body at all, and obviously they are, but they're not using it obtrusively. Merckx is just, you know, absolutely fighting his bike. It's something Walter Goddefroot described to me. You know, he's like a boxer on the bike.
And so what's his tactical sense? You know, is it just to go out and just go as fast as he can for as long as he can?
It's more subtle than that, because I can't remember who it was told me, but there was a sense always that Merckx was looking for the opportunity. And the riders never knew when he was going to make a move. He would seize any opportunity, crosswind, rain shower, crash. It didn't have to be a hill. It wouldn't have to be where the road was hard. It was anywhere and everywhere. I think that was the point. They never knew when it was going to happen.
He was also, Will, I think, very imaginative at times, particularly as he got weaker. And I think up until his crash in Blois, he had a famous crash in 1967 at the Velodrome in Blois, and it almost ended his career. He felt that he was much weaker after that crash. But I think even in 1970, 71, his style of racing started to change. And I don't think this is unique to Merckx. I mean, I think even if we look at the career of Lance Armstrong, I think in 1999 and 2000, he was able to just obliterate everyone. And it was the same with Merckx. And for two or three years, perhaps after 69, he was still by far the best. But he started to have to introduce tactical ruses that he used, for instance, in 1971 against Ocaña, where he was attacking downhill and from kilometre zero in races. And then particularly in 74 and 75... you know, his tactics finally failed him, and that was really the point where everyone else caught up.
I think 75 wasn't his tactics failed; his body finally failed him. But yeah, that was the thing with Ocaña was that in 71, obviously it was about maintaining that psychological pressure, wasn't it? Where the guy gets the jersey and absolutely wipes Merckx off the face of the earth. Basically, does to Merckx what Merckx has been doing to everybody else. But instead of sitting back and thinking, what am I going to do now? He's straight on the attack, the first possible opportunity, the next day's racing. And that means that Ocaña never gets to rest. And so he basically sets up Ocaña's crash in the mountains where Ocaña falls off. And he was trying to do similar things to Tavernier in the 1975 Tour, because Tavernier told me he was attacking every time the road went downhill. It was one of the most striking things I've ever heard. You don't conceive of guys taking every descent in the Tour flat out in the hope that an adversary will struggle and lose time, not necessarily crash, but will be a minute behind at the bottom of the descent. And Merckx, like you say, he did get very imaginative later on in his career, but that's experience, isn't it?
He rode all the races. I mean, if you look at his palmares, they're incredible by today's standards, or even by standards of the last 20 years. Was that Eddy Merckx, or was that just cycling at that time where the peloton did ride every race and there was much less specialisation than there is today?
It was a bit of both, Jack. I mean, I think it was normal for guys to ride 115, 120 days a year, whereas now the norm is sort of 80, 70. But Merckx would ride 150 days because he would do a full track program as well. There were years when he did 10, 12, 6-day meets in the winter. And riders didn't really have the form peaks that they have now. You know, riders today talk a lot about peaking twice in a season, and these form peaks tend to last, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, and then they disappear for a couple of months and then come back. Merckx's sort of performance graph was very level throughout the year. You know, yes, there were races when he was stronger than others, but he was on an extremely high level throughout the year.
So with all that racing, there wouldn't be much time, presumably, for training. But what kind of training did he do, and what was his approach to training and his conditioning his body? Or was it just conditioning by racing?
He just basically rode his bike. I mean, I had an amusing conversation with his Sergio Michels, where I asked him about the motorbike, and we see pictures of Merckx and footage of Merckx out with Guillaume on the motorbike and Eddie behind the bike. And today, a bike rider would be using a motorbike, you know, to build speed, to build intensity. And so I said to Guillaume, what did you do behind the bike? And he said, oh, I sat on the bike. We went along at a fairly steady pace. We'd go for it however long it took, you know. And there was no sense they were using it for training. The motorbike was there for company. I asked him, what did they do on rest days? He says, oh, there were no rest days. That was lovely.
I mean, that's a revealing anecdote. There were others, for instance, from Roger de Vlaminck. He told me he did 400 kilometres every Wednesday. He would have done 180 kilometres before 9 o'clock in the morning. So yeah, I think, you know, as Will says, a lot of it was just riding their bike. I mean, they really didn't know any different, and there was no great science in terms of physiology. And as far as they were concerned, they had to ride as often as possible and as hard as possible.
If there wasn't a very scientific approach to training, he was very obsessional about the setup of the bicycle. I recall that wonderful scene at the opening of A Sunday in Hell, probably still the best film about the bicycle, where Eddy Merckx is just checking and rechecking and the bicycle that's presumably already been set up for him by his own mechanic.
Yeah, it dates back to the crash in Blois. He was never really comfortable on the bike after that, and he becomes, like you say, totally obsessed. He used to carry an Allen key in his back pocket all the time. And there was a race somewhere that I was told about where he forgot the Allen key and got in a bit of a panic. And a team member had to go and find one in the shops and then hand it up at the feed station because he had to have his Allen key in case he needed to adjust his saddle.
Tell me about the crash.
It was actually a fairly nondescript, unimportant track meet of the kind that Merckx used to do a lot of after the tour. He used to do criteriums on the road and also these track meets. And he was in Blois for one of these with Anquetil. Anquetil was riding and various other, you know, stars of the Tour de France. It was a wet night, a small pokey velodrome. I actually visited as part of my research for the book, and I met a guy who was there that night. And about midway through the night's racing, another rider crashed into his Durney pilot and skidded across the track, and Merckx collided with him, had blood pouring out of his ear. People on the track actually thought he was dead. His Durney rider did die, and Merckx was taken to the hospital for 2 or 3 days. The prognosis was fairly uncertain. People didn't know if he would ever race again, whether he would ever get back to the same level. And about 9 days later, he was racing again, and that was that. One of his soigneurs, Goose Nasons, from that day, always used to refer to his two legs as his big leg and his little leg. His little leg was the left leg, which was handicapped to a certain extent after that. But you know, I don't know what Will found in his research, but speaking to a lot of the other guys, they didn't notice the difference. It was only that Merckx that had this obsession with his left leg being weaker than his right leg, and him being no longer being anything like the rider he had been up until that crash.
No one ever mentioned it to me, actually. No one ever said, oh, you know, he was three quarters of the bike rider as he was. I suspect it was all in his head. I mean, he was a great worrier anyway, and I think it was just something else to worry about. There's a lovely line from, I can't remember who it is, Dumont or somebody, that, you know, he's always complaining about, you know, having a knee problem or a cold or whatever, and then you'll go and win that afternoon. You know, so I think it was just it obviously was a really bad crash. It obviously did leave him with back trouble, but I think as for being much weaker, it's impossible to tell, really, isn't it?
A lot of the time you hear from cyclists at the top level that it's not so much the desire to win that is motivating, but the fear of losing. You hear that certainly about Lance Armstrong. I mean, for him, you know, coming second is a loss. You hear from Mark Cavendish. Do you think the same thing is true about Eddie Merckx, that he was sort of tormented by a kind of fear rather than a desire to win?
He's the only one you hear about complaining, you know, oh, a week's gone by, 4 days have gone by, and I haven't won a bike race. I mean, there's something very telling. I think it was Jeroen de Moink said that, you know, Merckx never really lost the amateur spirit. He never lost the joy of winning. He was like a kid who discovers, you know, riding on a toboggan and always just wants to go and do it again and again and again. And that's why I think it wasn't the money with Merckx. I think it was just this the high that, you know, if you win a bike race, you get a high. It doesn't matter what the level is. Just crossing that line first, you get a high. And I think that's what it was. And he just couldn't stop it.
Is that what makes him appealing to spectators, that he's just irrepressible?
Or unappealing, Jack. I think this was one of the problems that people had with him. He was... he could be single-minded, almost to a fault, and a lot of the other riders found this a little bit unpalatable as well. I mean, one French rider, Christian Raymond, told me about a criterium once when I think he was sprinting with Merckx for third or fourth place, and Merckx, actually, this was a rare occasion when Merckx let the other guy win, or let the other guy sprint ahead of him, Christian Raymond, and Raymond asked him why, and Merckx said, well, I don't want to come third. I don't want to be on the podium. I'd rather disappear. I'd rather be fourth, because I can't bear people to see me in a position of inferiority.
It's quite interesting looking through the results in the period between 1968 and 1974. It's 11 Grand Tour wins for Merckx and 9 for everybody else. Daniel, I mean, that's just inconceivable, isn't it?
Yeah,
did that turn people against him? Did that turn the spectators against him? Did they just thinking, oh God, it's Merckx again?
It did, and also he didn't bring a lot of pizzazz and a lot of charisma off the bike. He was very shy. One of the things that he used to emphasise was that he'd not really been prepared for the kind of things that journalists and the media were asking of him. You know, he didn't read a lot of books. He didn't see a lot of films. He didn't particularly enjoy holding forth on, you know, world affairs. And his answer to that, his solution was really to kind of cocoon himself and say as little as possible, or as few kind of interesting things as possible. And yeah, I think that was one thing that contributed to his unpopularity at times, particularly in France. And then at other times, he was just too ruthless. You know, he wouldn't leave even teammates. Even if teammates were away in a break and had the chance of winning races, he would often chase them down and take everything for himself. And that came across as, like I say, quite unpalatable at times.
That smacks of Lance Armstrong, and their men are great friends.
There are definitely similarities, aren't there? There was a very famous tour stage, when I think in 2004, where, you know, Armstrong took it, and the quote afterwards was "no gift." You know, and that's pretty much how it was with Merckx. There were no gifts. I mean, part of the thing about riding against his own teammates, I think that's insecurity, fear that the race might be lost. Because I remember Bob Long again telling me about when his sort of number two, Jos Breuer, got away in, I think, one of the Ardennes classics. And all the time, Eddie was saying, you know, what's happening at the break? What's the lead? Are they going to do it? You know, he was very worried that the race might be lost because he wasn't personally in charge. It was insecurity as well as ruthlessness. It was the ruthlessness born of insecurity, if you like.
So let's talk about the golden era of cycling. And perhaps, I don't know if it's a wider golden era of sport, because is it a coincidence that we have Eddie Merckx, Muhammad Ali and Pelé around about the same time at their best of their abilities, and they have subsequently gone on to be regarded as the undisputed greatest in their particular sports. Is that rose-tinted spectacles? Is that a kind of baby boom generation, that all of those three were baby boomers, and that's just when they kind of came to flower and they were the best of their generation, and it was a generation that has, in a sense, defined
the post-war era, you know, whether it's in politics, society, culture or sport.
You're right, Jack. You have to look at what else was going on outside sport, you know, in terms of music, particularly politics. But also, I think it's not insignificant that those were also the first years of colour television. I mean, I think the first Tour de France that was televised, that was widely televised in colour, was it 73? Will might be able to answer this, but it was certainly midway through Merckx's reign. And I think that changes the way we look back at those years, and you know, the first World Cup, I think the first World Cup final was 1970, that was broadcast in colour, I think, with Pelé as well, and the same with Ali. So I think that definitely changes people's perspective and lends a certain sort of modernity when people look back.
Because I had a Twitter discussion with, insofar as that's possible, with the photographer Camille McMillan, who was saying, there's no golden era. The golden era is now. Anything else is just marketing of the past to sell you a product.
Well, I think golden eras are a kind of in the mind to some extent. In the, you know, Italians would point at a golden era of cycling and they would say it was the late 40s, early 50s, Bartoli and Coppi, no question, no discussion. You talk to the French about a golden era of the Tour and they would say, well, the golden era was Anquetil and Poulidor in the 60s. Again, no question. Belgians cycling, they would say it was the 70s because you had Merckx and all the massive generation of Flandrian champions who were, you know, who were trying to beat him and on occasion succeeding. But going back to the question about the 70s, I mean, I think it would be interesting to look at it sociologically and, you know, question, you know, whether it's something about, you know, the first generation, you know, the generation that's born immediately at the end of the First World War, are they athletically better because, you know, diets suddenly improve or whatever, but their parents still have an economic hunger from the war? Who knows? There is probably a thesis to be written by someone in a university on it.
And so how do we compare now with then, looking at the sport? Is it a completely different sport?
Yeah, it's changed beyond recognition and it will never go back for reasons that I talked about earlier, about specialisation. Guys will never go back to riding 120, 130 days a year again, which is a shame. I think the riders, pound for pound, are fitter, considerably fitter now. I think, you know, today's best riders would be Eddie Merckx, as he was in, you know, as fit as he was in the 1960s. Does that detract from what he achieved in his era? Obviously not, because he made the best use of what was available at that time.
Let's talk about doping, because that obviously is a big difference between now and then. And there's an interesting time. The time of the Merckx era was a time a transition was going on in cycling, because prior to that, doping had been pretty much sanctioned and endorsed and accepted by the race organisers, by the riders, by the fans. Maybe the fans didn't know about it, but it was what it was, and the race organisers were party to it. Now, obviously, it's the great scourge of cycling, but that change didn't happen overnight. We can't say this was the doping era and this was the anti-doping era. This is a kind of period of change. Maybe it's a long period of change that Merckx is the beginning of.
I think you're right. I think it is a long period of change that starts, if you like, with the death of Tom Simpson in 1967, which is something I discussed at length in Simpson's biography that I wrote a few years ago. But that transition period, I would argue, that lasts until probably the late 80s, early 90s, at which point perceptions generally begin to change. And then there's the final sort of massive moment of change, if you like, is 1998. And that's the moment when people suddenly realise that doping can threaten an entire sport. And, you know, if you don't get a grip on the problem and if you let the problem become as endemic as it did, the sport is threatened, basically.
William, you've come in for a little bit of criticism for downplaying the doping in Merckx's era, which, you know, he failed dope tests. One has to assume that if most people were at it, he was at it too. Was that a conscious decision that you made, and how do you explain that?
I think it was a conscious decision, actually. It was basically, I decided that I was going to write a cycling book. As I said, my feeling about that transition period is that, you know, you accept it for what it is. It's a period when it's quite hard to work out what's going on. It's not like the modern era when there is a massive consciousness of what, you know, where it's at, and, you know, a regular spate of dope scandals. It's a very different era, basically. I just decided that, you know, that my book would have that particular focus, that it would be about bike racing and about the life of Merckx.
I think, just to come in on that, Jack, one of the misconceptions I tried to address in my book was that it was an era of light doping. That's something you often hear, that in the 60s and 70s, guys were only taking stimulants and substances like caffeine and strychnine that had been used for decades. But I actually found that the doping was a lot more sophisticated than people realised. Joop Zoetemelk admitted using blood transfusions in 1975. Lasse Wieren, the famous Finnish distance runner, was using blood transfusions in 1972. And cortisone was already around. Okay, it was legal and it was undetectable. Steroids were already around. So there was a fairly powerful panoply of doping products available. So was Merckx any more guilty than anyone else? I doubt it. A couple of guys that I spoke to raised that question. Did he have a product that other people didn't have access to? I think that's unlikely, but there are nonetheless three major asterisks next to his Palmarès, which are the three positive tests, and also I think probably more would have been uncovered if anti-doping methods had been a bit more sophisticated. The other thing that I found very disappointing, I still find disappointing about Merckx, is his attitude to the whole problem now. I don't think, I think we could give him the benefit of the doubt in terms of his career, but not really in his stance on doping now and his support of some people who have been convicted and discredited.
William, what's your take on what he's done in the anti-doping era?
I think it's maybe a little unfair to sort of expect everybody to change their attitudes overnight. I think it's also a bit unfair to sort of take black and white judgments of people. I think I don't agree with what Merckx has said about doping. Recently about not approving of the Contador's ban, his concerns about the no needles policy. I don't agree with those, but then again, it's obvious that the guy never set out to make friends. He never set out to influence people. He never set out to worry about public concerns, so why should he change now?
I want to get on to the role of cycling journalists, and doping is a big part of this, because there have been accusations of complicity between cycling journalists and athletes who've been cheating to win. How do you see your roles as journalists?
Well, I think we have a fundamental problem, which is that we're bound by libel laws, and the libel laws in Britain are stronger than any anywhere else. And that's a fundamental problem, and we have another problem, which is that it's not like political journalists going off and uncovering political scandals. We're not terribly well supported. We tend to be freelancers. We tend to, have to stand on our own two feet. It's not a situation which makes for, if you like, fearless investigative reporting.
It's quite easy for you to be co-opted into a corrupt system.
The other huge misconception, Jack, is that we know exactly what's going on. We simply don't. I can't think of a single case. I've been covering cycling for over 10 years, William, I think over 20 years, and probably neither of us can think of a single case when we have been absolutely sure that someone has cheated and they've subsequently been exposed. And that goes for the other riders as well. They do not know what their teammates are doing. Perhaps they did in the 1980s when you had minibars full of EPO, but that doesn't happen anymore. We know that. We've seen that. These guys are very secretive. The systems they have in place are very sophisticated. It all takes place, a long, long way from the public eye and from our journalistic eyes.
William, would you concur with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember once putting up a post on a blog which said that, it was after the 2007 tour where I wrote, who knows how many of these guys in the top 20 will be at the race next year, because there were doubts about so many of them. And someone someone responded to the post implying that I knew what was going on. It's incredible. As a journalist, you genuinely don't know a lot of the time. But it's not because you don't want to go and look. It's because just impossible to know. You can't go and look in the fridge of every bike rider in the bunch. It's just not possible.
Finally, I want to look at cycling today. Is it possible for a cyclist to come forward with the right physique, with the right attitude, and achieve the kind of things, obviously maybe not racing so many days, but to become as big a figure as Eddie Merckx was in his time?
I think there are cyclists out there who are probably physically capable of it, and quite possibly who might want, in theory, to win all those races. But I don't think it'll happen, because I think anybody who's physically got the ability and mentally got the right winning head will be channeled into one of the specialist areas, be it classics or tours. That's my feeling. What does Daniel think?
I agree, Will. I think it's a big shame. It pains me that not a single rider who was in the top 10 or even probably top 20 in the Tour de France last year even takes part in Paris-Roubaix or the Tour of Flanders. But that just is the reality. And going back to what you said earlier about a golden age, Jack, and whether that did exist, I think it's quite legitimate to sort of get nostalgic about the 60s and 70s purely for that reason, that, you know, there was sort of head-to-head combat between these guys on a week-to-week basis for 6-7 months of the year, which certainly doesn't happen anymore. We, you know, our breath is always bated for the Tour de France. That is the only time when a lot of what we consider to be the real, you know, A-listers actually come together, come into the ring together.
Maybe we're in our own golden age with Chris Hoy, Mark Cavendish and Bradley Wiggins going on to win the Tour this year. Is he going to win the Tour this year?
I think we are in this golden age, and I think he could well win the Tour this year. I think what's quite interesting with Brad is that his trajectory this year has been very similar to that of Cadel Evans last year. Cadel Evans was extremely good in March and then won the Tour of Romandy. Now, you don't draw too many things from that, but what's obvious is that Bradley's learning every year. I think the playing field in cycling has levelled a bit, which has helped him out as well. It's quite interesting to reflect on the fact that I think it was as recently as 2005 that there wasn't actually a single British rider in the Tour de France.
I think it is definitely a golden age for British cycling, Jack, as Williams just said. In terms of Bradley in this year's Tour, I think if you were to put him on the start line in Liège, you know, everyone, all the other contenders are at 100% on their best form. I think Bradley almost should win the Tour de France with the course there is. But when people make these predictions, they forget about all the imponderables.
They forget about the barbed wire fences that you're going to get thrown off into by a dodgy, badly driven French television car.
I mean, they also they have short memories. They forget that 2 years ago, Bradley seemed to, okay, not in as good a position as he is this year, but he went into the Tour de France with very high hopes and was completely downcast and a long way down in the general classification after a week and a half. Last year he crashed out. So, you know, those two recent experiences just underline what can go wrong. There are two things. One is being the best athlete and one is negotiating your way around the course better than anyone else. And both things have to fall into place, and one of them relies a lot on luck as well.
The point about cycling is what we love about it is that it's not mathematics. You can be the best guy, but you won't always win. And going back to Merckx, what makes Merckx so incredible is the fact that he managed to make this very, very unpredictable sport very, very predictable for so long.
Well, you can read more about Eddie Merckx in the biographies written by William Fotheringham, Half Man, Half Bike, and Daniel Freiber, Eddie Merckx, The Cannibal. Both are conveniently published by the same publisher.
Not exactly.
They're in the
same building.
Okay, in the same building. I mean, how did that one work out?
Will, do you want to take this? Should we reenact our telephone conversation of about a year ago?
It is quite funny because I phoned up Daniel. It would be, about a year ago now, actually. And Daniel phoned me up and asked me what I was working on, by as you do, in a sort of to make conversation. I said, I'm working on something, but I'll tell you when I've finished it. And he says, as long as it's not Eddie Merckx. At which point my heart sank and I just thought his did too, because, you know, you're a journalist and you both want to be first with the story, you know.
And have you read each other's book?
We've made a pact that we're not going to. Is that right, Will?
My feeling is that I would rather wait until I've finished my next book, probably, until my personal Merckx book has been consigned to history. Because what always happens is, you know, as a writer, you're always very self-critical of what you write. And I know that I'll go through Daniel's and go, oh, I wish I'd done that. I wish I'd found this witness. I wish I'd thought that. And I would hope that Daniel would do the same for mine.
Yeah, and also since they were published in the same building, hopefully our publishers might just take all the pages apart, stick the two books together and produce a definitive tome, bring that out next year.
I won't try and ask you which one of you is Eddie Merckx and which is Luis Ocaña or any of the other rivals that Eddie dispensed with such vigour on the roads of Europe. Thanks to both gentlemen for telling us a little more about the legend of Eddie Merckx. And if you are wondering which of those two books to buy, of course, the correct answer is by them both. They're both good reads, but they are both quite different books. The way I look at it is this. They're both set out to do different things. Daniel's book is a little bit more poetic, a little bit more impressionistic, whereas William's book is a bit more traditional, going for very thorough research, more of a race-by-race account of Merckx's career, whereas Daniel's focus is very heavily on the storytelling, on conveying the overall impression that Merckx made on cyclesport. And there are some lovely scenes in his book where he describes the people whose careers were destroyed or at least diminished by Eddie Merckx's brilliance. On the other hand, William really sets out to try and understand what's going on in Merckx's mind, what is driving him. And I'm not sure that he answers that question as well as one might have hoped, or in fact whether it's possible to answer that question, especially if you've not had, you know, a lot of time to spend with the man. It's worth saying that neither book directly benefits from any set-piece interviews with Merckx, although William Fotheringham's book does draw on a very extended interview that William did in the 1990s, but that is some time ago. So I think stylistically, I probably prefer Daniel's book, but if you're looking for blow-by-blow information and very thoroughly researched detail on the races, then it's probably William's you want to go for. Whichever one you choose, or if you choose both, I hope you enjoy them. And if you're living in a territory outside the United Kingdom where the books are not published as books, I'm sure you'll be able to track them down via the Kindle or other ebook readers. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week. Goodbye.